You're listening to episode 3, season 2 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers, we have Cody Keplinger on the show with us today, author of The Duff. Her book was made into a movie starring some of the hottest young actors. I watched the movie adaptation of her book, and I enjoyed it so much that I read Cody's book right after. Cody's writing is so refreshing, original, and hilarious. It blew my mind when I found out she wrote The Duff when she was only 17 years old. She's gone on to write countless other successful books, and I'm thrilled to have her on the show. In today's episode, we'll learn why a mentor is so crucial for our growth, and how having one has shaped Cody into the writer and the person she is today. And as always, we have really actionable writing tips and career advice for the Storyteller Tribe. We also have a very special giveaway announcement for today's episode. If you want to win a signed, advanced copy of Cody's newest book, Run, all you have to do is listen to Cody's podcast episode, tweet your favorite quote from Cody's interview, and tag at 88 Cups of Tea and include hashtag 88 Cups of Tea so we can find you. And the lucky winner gets to read her book ahead of time before it releases in June. Now let's jump right in.
Hey everyone! Oh my gosh, we have Cody Keplinger with us today. I am so excited. She is the author of The Duff, which stands for The Designated Ugly Fat Friend. Thank you so much for being here with us today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into questions about your books, I'd love to know how you fell in love with writing.
Honestly, that's a tough question. I don't entirely know. Because I was listening to your podcast last week, actually, with Victoria Aveyard, and she said she's always been a storyteller. And I'm like, that's me too. I don't remember how I fell in love with telling stories. I just remember that one of my earliest childhood memories was sitting at a typewriter in my mom's office, and there was no paper in it. And I couldn't even spell the word cat, but I was just sitting there clicking buttons and telling her this story that I thought I was writing. And as time went on, I just always came up with these story ideas. I would draw pictures. I liked to draw when I was a kid. And I'd draw these pictures. And as I would draw, I would actually start saying the dialogue that the characters in the pictures would be saying, like nice. Talking to myself as I drew. And I was socially conscious enough to know that that was weird, that I was sitting there talking to myself as like multiple people while I drew. And then somehow that turned into being I remember in third grade, we had our first like assignment to write like a story. And I thought that was the coolest assignment ever. I was like, I can write stories. And it just took off from there. I've been writing ever since.
Oh, nice. So from there, did you go to college knowing that you wanted to major in creative writing, or did you major in something else?
I did major in creative writing. It was sort of a weird process to get there, though. I've loved to write since I was a kid, but my mom always told me, you know, there are many famous writers who weren't famous until they were dead. You know, and she was like, that doesn't mean they weren't talented. It just, you know, it's all about timing and stuff. And she was like, you need a backup career. And my backup career was actress. I'm super practical. I did theater in school. I don't know that I was good. I went to a very, very tiny high school in the rural part of the South. So like we didn't really have a drama club. We did, but then it got disbanded because like everybody was more committed to Future Farmers of America and wasn't showing up for practice. And I did a little bit of plays like in middle school, but we only did musicals. And I cannot sing. I never got good parts, but I loved theater. And I also loved movies. And there was a time when I thought I wanted to be like involved in film somehow. Like weirdly, I wanted to be an editor specifically, like a film editor.
That's
which
awesome.
Is a very strange career choice for a girl who's legally blind.
Oh my gosh, because that's really specific too.
Well, it was because, okay, we're getting deep nerd now.
Okay, I love it. Bring it.
I made anime music videos.
What? Are you serious?
Yes.
Really quick, I know I digress, but what are some of your favorite animes, or what were some of your favorite animes?
I was deeply obsessed with Inuyasha when I was 15. I also really loved Blood Plus and Trinity Blood. Basically, if it came on Adult Swim, that was my only access to anime at the time. I loved it. But my favorite when I was 15, oh my God, Peach Girl.
Peach Girl. I have heard of it. I have not seen it. So you just schooled my ass on anime. So I'm going to have to check that out.
The most straight up teen drama anime you'll ever see. It is like a friend of mine described it as like anime crack, because like you start the first two episodes and you're like, oh, I'm not into this drama. And then immediately you're like, but what happens next? Who does she kiss next? It's so dramatic. When I was 15, I was like, this is amazing. I was such a nerd. I mean, I'm still a huge nerd. Let's be perfectly clear here. But yeah, I made anime music videos, AMVs.
So that's how you got into the editing?
Yeah, and I thought I was pretty good at it. I thought that that would be my career path, and it seemed like a more realistic goal than writing or acting when I was in high school. So I looked into a few different colleges, specifically thinking about doing film. And then it kind of cycled through a few different other ideas for my career, but I always kind of came back to, I knew that there was absolutely zero chance of me doing anything outside of the creative sphere. It just didn't make sense to me. All of my goals kind of fell in the same category. I was doing a program when I was just had finished my junior year of high school, so right before my senior year of high school. I don't really know how to explain the program, but essentially it's, when you're legally blind, before you go to college, you might go to sort of like a rehabilitation center. And it's not really about rehabilitation when in that particular situation. It's more about life skills and essentially making sure that you have the capability of kind of living on your own, essentially. But for me, the reason I went was because I was planning on going to college and the state was going to help me pay for part of it if I completed this program. And I had a Braille teacher. She taught me Braille. I don't really use Braille personally anymore. I learned it, but I don't really use it. But she taught me Braille. This Braille teacher was an older woman. And in my experience, old women had always been like very sweet. And she was this older woman who had the most potty mouth I've ever met. She was just so upfront about everything. Like, she never had a filter, and I loved her. And she had been a writing student when she went to school, and she was very passionate about literature and writing. And she read something I'd written, and she was like, you should major in writing. There are schools that have undergrads in writing, and this is what you should do, and you shouldn't let anyone tell you that that's unrealistic. And I mean, she was just so supportive in her very honest, like, straightforward way.
So she was like your mentor.
Yeah, in a lot of ways she was. I needed someone who I knew wasn't telling me to do this just because they felt like they had to. Like, you know, the people in my family, some of them were supportive of me, like wanting to be a writer. But I always wondered if it was just because they felt like they had to be.
Right, out of obligation because of family.
Yeah. And some people were just like, no, you can't go out of state for college. You're crazy. You're 17 and you're blind. Like, what are you talking about? But she had no reason to tell me that she supported me in this. I mean, she was just the most direct person I'd ever met in my life. And for someone that direct and that honest and like that kind of outside of my spectrum of like limited life experience to support this and like to tell me I should, like, was completely eye-opening for me. I went right from her classroom literally to a computer and started researching undergrads in creative writing.
Oh, incredible. Huge thanks to her. Do you still keep in contact with her?
I haven't seen her in years, but I don't live in the state anymore. And I think she moved out of the state as well. She was probably the best person I could have met at that point in my life.
You're really lucky that you had her to guide you at such a pivotal moment in your life.
I only really was around her for about 3 or 4 weeks in that brief period of my life. But it changed so much of my course of action.
Do you feel like having her in your life shepherded you towards perhaps trying out workshops for writing classes and similar things like that?
Most definitely. She really completely changed what I thought I was capable of, because I always thought, you know, I'll write, but I'll get a different job and maybe the writing will go somewhere and maybe it won't, but I'm not really going to try, kind of a thing. And she kind of had this very different mentality of like, if you want to do this, you should do this. She was like, look, I'm not telling you to be unrealistic. I'm not telling you you shouldn't, you know, have a backup plan of some sort. She's like, but your backup plan shouldn't be your first plan. If this is what you want to do, then do it. And, you know, there are other things you can do with a creative writing degree if that's what you end up doing. She was amazing. She really was. I honestly don't know if I would have become a writer had it not been for her, which is a funny thing to say because I didn't even end up staying in my creative writing major for very long. I was a major for 2 years and I left college.
Oh.
But it didn't matter. She'd already sort of lit that spark and made me say, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm focusing on. And I'm not going to be unrealistic. I'm going to think logically about things and not have too high expectations, but I'm going to shoot for the stars.
I love that you're paying a whole huge tribute to her, because I love bringing up the topic of having mentors and what guests think on the show about having mentors, if they think it's necessary or not. It just shows, like, everyone is here. No matter what level we are, there's always room for growth and there's always more room to learn. And it just shows, like, when you find that person in your life that has the best intentions for you and for your future and can see things that you can't see, honest things, that's so critical and so crucial to moving you forward, like, so much faster than you would have if you were doing it yourself. I found a mentor similar to yours. I call her my mentor, you know, like, she has no choice, but she has to, like, accept it. And so Claudette is her name, Claudette Sutherland. And every time I went to her workshop class, I left feeling like my life was changed. She was amazing at critiquing and telling us about structures and technical aspects of writing, but also about life overall. Like, I felt like a changed human being, almost like I was in therapy class, which it wasn't therapy, yes. But, like, you know, it just...
I believe that writing workshops oftentimes end up being very therapeutic.
It's really great. And the trust and bond that you form with your fellow classmates, well, not classmates, your workshop mates, it's unbelievable. And I always think very highly of them and wish each and every one of them the very best. And I always have a place for them in my heart. Like, it's just ridiculous. So for listeners listening, if you haven't checked out workshops or anything like that, please check them out. And it'll be like the support group that you never expected.
Oh, completely. You know, I actually teach children's book writing workshops. I've also done a little bit of private teaching and stuff too. And what I always tell my students, I tell them on week one, and I can always tell they don't necessarily believe me. My workshops are usually about 10 weeks. And I can always tell they don't believe me on week one, but I tell them, I'm like, look, right now it seems awkward and you feel uncomfortable sharing your work and you don't know each other. Mm-hmm. I was like, very quickly, you guys will feel like you know each other better than you've ever gotten to know someone like this. And I always tell them, make friends now, because you're going to want to keep doing this and keep getting together, and you're going to want to keep seeing each other and, you know, maybe even workshopping outside of this class. And I encourage you to, because it's so important to have that community. I remember my last class, I had one student who loved science and was very picky when science didn't make sense in something.
Oh, that's so cute.
And we all knew. So we would get to her and we would all immediately go, we know what you're going to talk about. It was just, everyone really got a vibe for who each other was. And I think that happens in workshops. It's almost inevitable, because you're bearing part of your soul. Even if the writing you're doing has nothing to do with you as a person, even if it's not autobiographical, by sharing it and by critiquing others' work, you get to know each other really well and you develop this intimacy that I think is so different than what you find in a lot of other career paths.
Yeah, I agree. A support system makes a huge difference. Cody, I'd love to know why you chose to specifically write for the young adult and the children's book audience. Is there a reason why you chose that rather than for adults?
I have been writing about teenagers since before I was a teenager.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. My first novel, pretend that there are air quotes around that, I wrote when I was 11, and it was 60 pages long and 16-point font. But it was straight up like if Harry Potter and Sabrina the Teenage Witch had a weird baby written by an 11-year-old.
Not trying to be your manager or anything, but maybe you should look into that, because that actually sounds pretty enticing. I would totally check that out.
Wait, can I tell you the title?
Yes, please.
Hilarious and amazing. The Warning of the Scarlet Moon.
Oh my God, yes! Please. And then they'll make an anime out of that.
And this was pre me discovering anime too, ironically. But it was so Harry Potter. Like, instead of having a scar, my main character had a birthmark shaped like a star. And there was a prophecy. And anyway, there was another realm. I mean, it was straight up if Sabrina and Harry Potter were merged, that's what this was. It was about 16-year-olds, and I was 11. You know, a couple years after that, or maybe it was just the year after that, The OC premiered. And like, that was a life-changing experience for me.
I never watched it. I wasn't allowed to. I actually never even watched Clueless.
Okay, you have to correct this, because I will tell you, Clueless is still real good and is infinitely better if you've read the book Emma. It's a modern adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. No, I had no idea. No, okay, so I'll read Emma first and then I'll check out Clueless, yes? That's a good order?
It's way funnier if you know it's classic source material. I love when teen comedies adapt classic literature. I mean, 10 Things I Hate About You, like, come on.
Oh, yeah, that was a great fucking film. Like, oh, excuse my language.
I'm sorry. Have you read anything I've written? I am clearly okay with this.
I really love The Duff.
If you read The Duff, happen, then you know that I am very much okay with swearing. I did a word search after I finished the final draft of the Duff to see how many times I used the F-bomb. It was almost 70. I believe it was like 60-something times.
But it didn't feel like that. I think because you used it in a way that wasn't blatantly obvious. When I read some books and they use the F-bomb, like, the language didn't make sense. Does that make sense?
I completely agree.
So the way you use the F-bomb worked with that tone, and I think also through your characters as well.
It was her voice. My editor even added.
You're kidding me.
I was afraid she would ask me to take a few out, which I would have done because there were a lot. But she actually was like, I feel like this is just Bianca's word. And like, this is just what she says. And she would definitely say it right here.
Talking about that, and I know how much you love those classic teen movies. The Duff was awesome, obviously, all thanks to your book. How excited were you when it was made into a film?
It's still very surreal for me, honestly. You know, it came out last year, but it was sort of in the works a long time before that. The film option sold before the book had even hit shelves.
Wow. Do you have any idea, like an overview of how that works? Like, how does it go from your book in your hands to your publishers, to your editors and whoever's involved, and then getting shepherded to suddenly a movie option?
I understand the publishing part, like how it gets to a publisher and editor and all of that. I have a literary agent. He shepherds a lot of book-to-film adaptations. And so a producer read it, and she liked it, and she took it to another production company that was McGee and Wonderland, and they bought the option. You know, I was informed by my agent very quickly, like, the option does not mean for sure that it will be a movie. Lots of things are optioned that never really go anywhere. That's just how Hollywood works. And I was like, okay, probably won't happen, but yay, it's nice someone's interested. And then CBS Films signed on and bought the rights as well. And things really started changing from there. And I remember getting the call. I actually got the call from my film lawyer randomly. I had been having a really terrible day, like a really bad day. And I'd come home and I'd taken a nap, and I was stressed out about so many things. I woke up with my phone ringing, and I answered it, and it was my film lawyer. And he it was a very, like, strange way to tell me, but like something along the lines of, so have you seen any good movies lately? Well, I have a feeling that you'll be able to see a pretty good movie because they're going into production.
Oh my gosh. Tell me you screamed.
I think I was too stunned to scream, and also I was still half asleep. I wasn't entirely sure for a few hours after that if I had dreamed it. It's easy to not remember that day now because it's like, well, here's what I remember about that day. Bad, and then I got a phone call. And then suddenly it wasn't bad.
Now, talking about good and bad, what was the worst moment in your career that you remember that has happened to you that you feel like you thought you weren't able to get out of it, but you finally got yourself out of it somehow?
I had a book that I had written when I was 18. I had written it after I wrote The Duff, called Goldfish. It was a book that was really special to me, and special enough that I waited a long time before, like, letting my agent submit it to my publisher. You know, it was a few years before I let her show it to my publisher, and my publisher liked it, so they signed on for it, and then I was working in edits. I don't know if I just wasn't capable yet of really handling the edits for that particular project. Or if it was just that me and my editor kind of had different visions of the book and didn't realize we had different visions until it was too late, which sometimes happens. Like, you want to be sure you're on the same page with your editor, and sometimes you might think you're on the same page, but that's one reason it's so important to, like, really make sure that's clear. And I didn't really – we'd been on the same page for three books before this. So, like, it never dawned on me we might be looking at the book differently until we had done so many edits on it. And it just hit me that I don't think we're talking about the same things anymore. I was so stressed out writing the book. I rewrote most of it at one point, and I didn't like what I'd rewritten. And we ended up deciding to cancel the book. At the time, I didn't know that's somewhat common. Like, it happens. Like, I now know other authors who've been through very similar experiences, and it just, that's kind of part of.
Doesn't make it less painful, though. That was your baby, you know?
Honestly, canceling it was less painful than the aftermath, which was that I didn't realize it until I was out of it a few months later, but I definitely was depressed after we canceled it. I think I felt like a failure, you know? And logically, I knew, like, this is just happens. But, like, my brain was like, you've always been good at this, and now you can't finish this? What's wrong with you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to write again. that was the hardest part, was that I didn't want to write for a long time.
So your confidence in writing was crushed, basically.
It wasn't so much confidence as it was like every time I would sit down to write, I would get no more than a chapter in and I would just start panicking because I would already start imagining the difficult edits and like this fear of like, what if I can't do this either? And what if I, you know, just keep failing? It was not a comfortable place to be. And luckily, I am someone who is very pro-therapy and was already had a therapist at this point. So that helped a lot. But what ended up kind of saving me in a way was I sold the proposal to Scholastic for my middle grade novel, The Swift Boys and Me. I don't remember if it was before or after we canceled this book. It must have been after. And so I had to write the book. I sat down and I wrote this middle grade novel and I got through it and it felt good. Like that was it. It was the first time in a long time that writing had felt really good. That book really got me out of a funk and made me realize I loved to write again.
Do you think you would ever go back to that book that was scrapped and like revisit it?
Probably not at this point. I might use pieces of it as far as ideas because I really, at the time, I really loved it. And I now realize certain things about it. Like, I think in some ways I was also in over my head. Like, I wrote it when I was 18. I don't think I had the life experience to be writing that particular project at that point in time. So I might pull pieces of it that I liked, things that still resonate with me.
But not fully resurrect it right now.
Maybe not ever. And I think I'm okay with that. Like, I used to feel like I needed to resurrect it at some point. Like, I don't know, you know, weird way to, like, prove something to someone. I don't know who, like, that I could. But, like, now I'm kind of at peace with it. I'm like, you know what? That was a learning experience. Like, it was unpleasant at the time, but I learned a lot from it. A, I think I learned in some ways how to be a better writer in a very strange way, and that I faced one of the hardest writing experiences of my life. And while the book didn't end up making it to shelves or anything, like, I got through it and I kept writing eventually. But B, it taught me a lesson of like communication, you know, and I've always been someone that I get my edits and I dive in and I immediately kind of, you know, start on it. But it's definitely made me more communicative when I work with my editor and with my agent and with really, you know, anybody on my work, and to just make sure that we are speaking the same language before I dive in on a project.
This is definitely news to me. I didn't realize that editors and authors, it's quite common for them to have different ideas.
Editing and writing is a very collaborative process, and you have to be communicating. And it was just one of those situations where we weren't on the same page. We were kind of in separate places on the project, and we had separate visions of what the project was. We had already edited this project, and kind of both of us, I think, had kind of lost where we had originally started from, like that common starting place.
Now let's rewind to the Duff. Let's just say when you first met your editor has never worked with you before, because Duff was your first one they worked with her on. How did that work?
Every editor works differently, just as every writer works differently. I've only had two editors, so I can only really speak to my experience, which was pretty similar with both of them, actually. So with the Duff, I'll start there. I was 17 when I wrote the Duff, so I had no idea anything about publishing. I had done enough research to know that I needed an agent, and that was about it. I was like, they'll tell me the rest.
And to get that agent, did you send your manuscript and a cover letter to the ones you thought would best represent your work?
You send query letters, and usually you don't send a full manuscript. Like, they usually have, like, their guidelines will say either just a query or maybe, like, the first 5 pages in the body of the email. And if they're interested, they'll request to read the manuscript. I don't remember how many people, but I sent out some queries, and one agent asked to read my partial. So I sent the first 30 pages, and then the next morning she was like, can you send me the full manuscript? And that was on a Friday that she asked for me to send her the full manuscript. And so I did. And then by Monday she emailed me and said, can I call you tomorrow? And I said, sure, but it will have to be after 3. I didn't specify why. It was because I was still in high school. And
oh my gosh.
She didn't know that. That was not in my query letter. And so she called me and it was a great conversation. And she loved the book and she had some really cool ideas for some small edits that she wanted to do. But she really wanted to be, you know, submitting it fairly soon. And we hit it off. And she was like, do you have any questions for me? And I said, not really, but you should probably know my mom's going to have to co-sign everything. And she goes, why? And I said, I'm still 17.
Oh my God. What did she say?
She paused and she goes, oh my God, you're 17. I said, yeah, is that a problem? She goes, no, it just, can I talk to your mom? So, and I was like, oh, you know, mom's not home right now. So she called back a couple days later and she just had to have a conversation. I think legally she had to have a conversation with both me and my mother to make sure that my mom knew and gave consent for me to be doing this. And my mom did and was very supportive. So I started working with her and we worked a little bit on the manuscript. And then she submitted it to editors at several different publishing houses. And then about 2 weeks later, she called me to let me know that we were going to auction and that more than one of the publishers was interested in the manuscript. I was like, I know a lot of people who have agents and it still takes them a few years to ever sell a project. Like, I'm 17. It's just not going to happen, you know, and I'm glad that an agent is interested, but it's not going to happen. So to get that call was like mind blowing. I still am kind of amazed it happened.
What inspired you to write The Duff?
The Duff was inspired by a weird cluster of things. The first being that I had this idea in my head for a long time of wanting to write a love-hate relationship. I was really interested in that dynamic when I was 17. I'd read Pride and Prejudice and loved it. I watched a lot of Gossip Girl and loved Chuck and Blair. And so I kind of wanted to write it, like mostly for fun. This wasn't even, I wasn't even thinking of publishing yet at this point. Like I knew I wanted to be a writer and I knew I was going to major in writing in college, but I wasn't thinking about writing to be published quite yet. Like I was still writing mostly to amuse myself. Mm-hmm. And so I had this idea, but I didn't really know what to do with it or, you know, what it was or where it needed to go. And then the word duff was introduced to my vocabulary. I did not make that word up. That is a real thing. It's been in Urban Dictionary for a very long time. And a girl in my high school was telling me a story, and she was saying something about how she hated it when guys referred to her or one of her friends as a duff. I didn't know what it meant, so I asked her, and she told me that it meant the designated ugly fat friend.
Oh.
It was my first time hearing it. I remember having like three reactions. My first being like, oh, that's hilarious. And then being like, oh, wait, that's really mean. And then being like, oh, crap, that's me. I am the duff of my group of friends.
Oh, wow.
I went and told my friends this. Like, I told them this story. And they were all like, no, 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 but I'm the duff. You know? And I was like, that's ridiculous. And they're like, no, but you're so smart. And I'm this and that. And I realized that in a group, most of the time, almost everyone in the group thinks that they're the duff. Even if it's not about being ugly or fat, even if it's just being about like, I'm not the most talented, I'm not the most charming, whatever it is, everyone feels that.
Mm-hmm.
It started as a joke. I jokingly told my friends, I'm going to write a book one day called The Duff. But unlike every other like ugly duckling story, like she's not going to take off her glasses and take out her ponytail and suddenly be a supermodel, you know, a la like She's All That. I love that movie, but come on.
Yes, it was a fantastic movie.
I love that movie, but come on. She was never unattractive.
Yeah. She's super pretty. I don't believe that. I don't buy it for one second.
Well, they make fun of it to perfection in Not Another Teen Movie.
I did not watch that.
It's fine. Not everything about it is funny, but some of parts of it are so spot on. And they do a makeover scene and the girl's like, I'm going to change your appearance completely. And she literally just takes off the main character's glasses and takes out her ponytail. And she goes, I'm done. And I didn't want that. I didn't want a character who changed at the end of the story as far as how her appearance was.
Which is actually a big reason why I love your take on it. And I thought it was really refreshing. But yes, continue.
Thank you. But I also didn't want, you know, in a lot of these stories, like the ugly duckling girl is like this sweet angel of a character, and like the moral of the story at the end is that everyone should have like given her a chance because it's all about inner beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted a character who wasn't necessarily an angel, that was a little bit bitchy and, you know, and snarky and could be mean and selfish sometimes, just because she is seen by some people in her school as being like not conventionally attractive, I guess. Like, doesn't mean that she has to be an angel too. Like, I'm a chubby girl. I'm allowed to be mean sometimes. That doesn't make me less valuable as a person.
That's true.
And then one day, I don't know, it just kind of hit me that my love-hate relationship story and this idea of the duff were the same book. And the rest is history.
That's so awesome. And you basically created this character, Bianca, from what you wanted to see and also what you didn't like about other films.
When I decided to write the duff, I kind of wanted to write a character that girls who still felt like, look, makeover is not going to suddenly make me, you know, the prom queen.
I think it's incredible that you're able to flesh out such a character like that with so much depth. So there was no one, like not even a friend, that inspired you a little bit to give her, Bianca, those quirks and those attitude that she has and her thought processes.
Oh gosh, Bianca's like an amalgam of a lot of my friends in a way.
She's like too layered to just be someone that you created from like what you want to see.
Honestly, I didn't consciously base her on anyone. Her voice hit me. Like, when I say that when I realized suddenly that the Duff and my love-hate relationship story were the same story,
yeah.
I honestly mean suddenly. It just hit me, and I had the first few lines of the book immediately. I've never written a book that fast in my, like, since then. It took about a month and a half for the first draft. And it's a short first draft, admittedly. Like, I added quite a bit in revisions. I couldn't stop. Like, her voice was just in my head. It's hard to explain, but I heard it. When I sat down to write the book, I didn't really know who Bianca was. She just kind of started coming to life as I wrote her. I didn't realize that she was going to be this very cynical character. I didn't realize some of the stuff about her home life until I got there. That's unusual for me now. I don't write that way anymore. That book was very different.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. And now how do you write? Do you write with structure and like a plot line?
So I wrote that book without an outline. And then I wrote my next book, A Midsummer's Nightmare, also didn't have an outline. I also wrote that one very, very quick with no outline. And that book got rewritten quite a bit in revision. And every other book I've ever written has had a chapter by chapter outline.
What inspired you to suddenly have that chapter by chapter outline? Did you take a class that suggested it?
No, not at all. I think it was because, so I sold Shutout, which is my second book. Mm-hmm. I sold it on proposal. And so what I was supposed to do was to write the first 5 chapters and then do a long synopsis. Like, and we're talking a long synopsis, like at least 10 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't know how to do that. And the only way I knew how to do that was to come up with some sort of outline and then fill it in. Basically. And that was a really stressful process for me the first time. Now I've written multiple books on proposal and I actually quite like it. I outline in a way that won't make sense to anyone else. Like, I do chapter by chapter outlines, but my chapter outline is like, it's always written almost in like a language no one else understands. Cause it's like chapter 1, argument with mom. Chapter 2, confrontation with sister. You know, it's like, this is not going to give any information to someone seeking knowledge of what the plot of the book is, but it somehow makes sense in my head, and then I write from there.
That's actually really funny that you bring that up, because my mentor that I mentioned, Claudette, told me and my workshop mates that if we're ever stuck, try outlining chapter by chapter. I tried a little bit of that technique, and my gosh, it really is helpful. It helps you really strategize and keep things succinct. And the interesting thing when you said your first 2 books were written, the first drafts were very short. I wonder if that also really helped, because that was like a really great way to have an overview of where your story was going and perhaps helped more during editing when you had a shorter first draft.
I always write short. Every book I've ever written has been at least 10,000 words shorter than the final draft.
That's pretty genius, because you're doing your own version of an outline in a way.
Yeah, and it's not intentional. I prefer it. Don't get me wrong. I would much rather add than cut. I've had to cut before, and I find it a little more difficult. And I love adding stuff. The first draft of The Duff was 53,000 words. The final draft of the book, I believe, is about 67,000 words.
Oh,
that's pretty normal for me. Most of my first drafts come in between like 45 and 55,000 words. And then the final drafts are usually between 60 and 70,000.
Oh, wow.
So I usually end up adding, on average, between 10 and 15,000 words in revision.
And now, with all of that experience that you've had so far in your writing career, is there any advice that you would give to beginner storytellers who are primarily wanting to write for young adult fiction or even middle grade readers? Do you have any suggestions or advice for them?
I have kind of, I guess, 3 pieces that I always give. The first, and I would say the most important, is to read. I get a lot of people saying that they want to write young adult or middle grade fiction and then haven't read a young adult or middle grade novel in years. And I'm always like, why do you want to write for that age group then? And it's just because they have fond memories of reading as a kid. And I'm like, okay, that's great. But you should be aware of what's out there now.
Mm.
I actually make my students, whenever I teach a 10-week course, my students have to read at least 1 YA and 1 middle grade novel that have been published within the last 5 years.
Mm.
A lot of my students come in having not read a young adult, you know, a book for teenagers or children since they were a teenager or a child. And
mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, well, I want you guys to get a sense of what's out there. And so I think that's very important. I also will say I am someone who I've learned more about writing through reading than anything else. I ever learned the kind of writer that I want to be. The second piece I always give is be okay with hearing the word no, and don't let that stop you. The thing is, every writer is going to get rejected at some point in their life. Whether that's rejected from an agency, whether that's rejected from a publisher. Heck, you still get rejection even when you're published. I mean, that's the thing that people don't realize. It's not like you get one book published and then all of a sudden every book you ever write is going to get published. You still have to be submitted again. Like, there's still the risk of rejection. And most writers will still get rejected, even if they're brilliant writers. Not every book makes it to shelves. Even if the book is good, not every book makes it to shelves. And that goes along with any artistic career, I feel like. So I always have to say, you know, be okay with hearing the word no and start reinterpreting no as not for me or not right now. Don't let just think that just because someone told you no once means it's no forever, because that's not the truth at all. And then my last piece of advice is don't rush yourself. A lot of people, especially teenagers, I get a lot of emails from teenagers, I guess because I wrote my book when I was a teenager, that are like, I want to be published before I'm 18. And I always cringe a little bit and say, look, you can't control when you're going to be published. Mm-hmm. You can't. You can control other things. And so my advice to my students is always set goals that are goals you can control. Set goals for when you want to finish your manuscript. Set goals for when you want to, you know, have your project to beta readers or when you want to be querying agents. Set those goals. But you cannot control when you'll get an agent or when your book will sell.
Mm.
Those things are out of your control. You can control these other elements.
And now talking about controlling the elements, the things that are in your power, how do you go about with your writing schedule? Do you set a certain time every single day, or do you just kind of go with the flow of whenever you feel like working? Because I know there are some authors who have, they quote unquote, set work days for writing. Other authors just kind of just go with it, but they try to make a commitment every single day. How strict are you about like a writing regimen or structure for yourself?
It depends on if I'm on deadline or not. If I'm not on deadline, I just write when I feel like I can. Sometimes that means I write a ton in one day, and sometimes that means I write a paragraph. Sometimes it means I don't write at all. I mean, I'll be honest, I haven't written anything this week.
Oh, okay.
I will say if I go too long without writing anything, I start getting antsy and the creative bubble starts going a little haywire.
How do you know what it is that you want to write?
When you figure that out, you tell me. I used to be someone that had constant ideas. Like I couldn't finish projects because I always had new ideas that seemed better. And I'm not that way anymore. I always do come up with ideas, but my rule is that if I come up with an idea, because I usually have a new idea a couple times a month. Even when I can't write something new, even when I'm working on something else.
Mm.
And my rule is that if a new idea hits me, I have to sit on it for a while. I can't write a word. I can't even write the idea down. And if a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, I'm still thinking about that project, then it's something that's going to stick. Because if my brain is still interested 3 weeks later, even though I haven't been feeding it by writing anything down, if I keep coming up with new elements to it, well, then that might be something I should explore. But I have so many ideas that hit me. I'm like, this is a brilliant idea. And then 3 days later, I don't remember it. And that, to me, that means it probably wasn't as brilliant as I thought it was at that moment.
That reminds me of this advice that my UCLA novel writing teacher told us. She said, write what you cannot stop thinking about that just keeps haunting you. You need to write about that and go fully flesh out that story and those characters.
And I know other writers are different. They write down, they at least jot down the idea for everything, and then they might come back to it. I used to write down every idea I had. And then I just had a whole drawer of ideas that I knew I was never going to come back to anymore because I didn't feel any passion for them. Like, the passion fizzled within a day or two. But if the project is in my head without even having been written down for more than a week, I'm like, oh, you might be something interesting.
Cody, I would like to know, I know that you mentioned earlier when we first started talking, the person that's like your mentor. So that definitely was life-changing. Now, is there anything else that's almost similar to that, where it's more so of an event that you can recommend to listeners, to me, to check out? Do you have anything that impacted you so much the way your mentor did through an event that you can actually attend that we can also attend or check out?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. This is going to sound strange. So keep in mind my background here. Very small town.
Okay.
Very rural, very insular. I never met an author when I was growing up, ever. Book signings never happened near me. That was just not remotely close to reality. The big one that was life-changing for me, and that I think this was going to be true for a lot of people who don't grow up in cities, was getting to go to my first book signing. And not me signing, but going to another person's book signing and like meeting an author in real life. And I remember just being so excited and inspired when I left because I was like, I want to go write. I met real life writers and like signing books and like I got to see like their fans like crowding around them and I got to hearing them talk about their process, you know, and I had writing friends online, but like you said, like when you meet people in person that are kind of in your field, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd done workshops at this point too with other students, but it was my first time seeing like a professional writer at a book signing, specifically like doing this thing that was kind of mythical to me until that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, that really like hit me in a really wonderful way. I was just like, wow. I always tell my students, I'm like, you guys live in New York, go to book signings. Like they are incredibly, you'll be surprised how inspired you are just by hearing other authors talk. For me specifically, what really got to me was hearing the authors like have a Q&A and then seeing them holding their real life books. It was like, oh, this is like a real, like this is real for them. And this is, you know, this is something that could really happen for me.
I'm just thinking, it's just like you right now talking to me and listeners have access to what it is you're talking about. So it's like a book signing, but with a Q&A in their pocket, whatever they're doing, whether they're working out or like showering or doing chores. And they're hearing the Q&A and hearing about your real life journey, hearing all of your inspiring, motivational tips and advice for them as well. It makes a huge difference. So thank you for mentioning that, Cody. That's really cool. And that's really like very, very doable, very actionable. People, especially in big cities, have very easy access to. So there's no excuse there.
Wherever your closest city is, look and see if there are ever book signings there. I know some cities there's not as many as others and it's frustrating. But if you can find one, and if you're a teenager, if you can get your parent, convince your parent to take you, if you're an adult, make the trip.
Cody, I would love to know, what is inspiring you with your work right now? What is exciting you?
I actually do have a book coming out in June called Run. It's a very special book to me. It's probably the thing I'm proudest of having written. It's a little bit different from anything else I've done before.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It is about two girls from a small southern town in Kentucky who run away from home. And the story is told through both of their perspectives, but in different timelines.
Oh, that's cool.
So Agnes, one of the main characters who is legally blind, tells the story of how she met Beau, who is kind of the girl from the bad family in town. The opening line of Agnes's first chapter is, every town has a family like that, basically, and sort of narrates how they became friends and the events that led up to them running away. And Beau, interweaving chapters, narrates from the night they ran away to show what actually happened after. So you're piecing together why they ran away while you're also seeing the events of what happens once they hit the road.
That is freaking awesome. What made you want to write it that way?
I love nonlinear storytelling. I like when the author makes me work a little bit for it, yeah. Like when I'm trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
And this story, as it sort of hit me, I knew who the characters were, and I sort of realized this has to be told in two points of view and in two different times. It didn't make sense to only tell it from the point that they run away, but it didn't make sense to only tell it from, you know, to have them run away in the middle of the book after showing how they became friends and the events led to them running away. Just that didn't work for me because I felt both of them had journeys, but their journeys happened at different parts of this one big journey, if that makes sense. I feel like Agnes does her most growth in the events leading up to the running away. And I feel like Beau does the most of her growth after they run away. And their stories really mirror each other in a way. So I felt like it made sense. It was tricky. It was really tricky. I had to have a really concrete outline and clearly labeled who was narrating what chapter and figure out how they all work together and make it in a way that felt like the chapters went together and didn't just feel really like disjointed. And it was tricky, but I love that kind of storytelling. And so I really worked on it. And it was funny because I remember saying after I finished, like, okay, well, I love nonlinear storytelling, but that was a little challenging. I'm probably not going to do that for a while. And then literally every idea that I have come up with since for what might be my follow-up, like that's still not concrete what it's going to be yet, but every idea I've had is even more nonlinear.
Love it.
So I'm like, clearly I am a glutton for punishment and I'm gonna keep doing this, apparently. But you did ask what's inspiring me. And I guess what I will say, I listen to a lot of female-driven alt-country music while I wrote that book.
Ooh, nice.
I have a playlist that I've made for it. I haven't put it online yet, but my playlist is 50% Brandi Carlile.
Ooh. Do you usually listen to music when you're writing your stories?
I listen to music to get me ready to write my stories, but usually while I'm actually writing, I do listen to music, but it's usually something that I am so familiar with that I don't feel like I have to pay attention, if that makes sense. So like Brandi Carlile, I do write to Brandi Carlile a lot. And it's mostly because I'm so familiar with her work and I find her voice so comforting that it just is able to kind of fade. You know, it makes it easier to write. I listened to her a lot while I was writing Run, and it worked because she's got kind of a Southern style to her work, you know, being alt country. And the book is, you know, written in a kind of a Southern vernacular. So I feel like every book I've written has a playlist, but also has just a specific artist that I listen to the most while I wrote them. Like that I would just put on their album or something and just let it play straight through while I tried to get work done. On my website, I have the playlist for everything I've written. And so Run will eventually be up there as well.
Are there any books out there that you can recommend to us?
I have two. The first is Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. I had to read it when I was in college, and it was the best thing that any writing professor ever assigned.
Yes, preach, girl.
I didn't want to read it at first. Like, I admit that maybe I was a little bit arrogant at that point, because I was like, I've already sold a book, and I hate reading nonfiction. Like, I love reading nonfiction now, but at, you know, 18, I did not love reading nonfiction. I did not realize that it was also memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And man, that book is amazing.
Life-changing.
Like, it resonated with me on so many levels, and it completely changed how I look at my own drafts. It also completely changed how I look at memoir. And, like, I love reading memoirs now. And also, there's a scene in that book that I will never forget where she talks about how she hates when people ask her what she does for a living. Because when she says, I'm a writer, they are like, oh, have I heard of you? And she's like, probably not.
Yes.
And then they're like, no, I read a lot. You know, what have you written? And then she says her name and what she's written. They're like, no, I haven't heard of you.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
It's so true. And I remember reading that scene. It was before my book had come out. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I remember living that exact conversation. Like, people are like, what do you do? And I'm like, I'm a writer. Oh, I probably have heard of you. Who are you? And then I say, oh, I haven't heard of you. Yeah, you know, it's like. And then for fiction, this is a little more recent, but I'm going to sound like a little bit of a cliche here. But I loved Eleanor and Park by Rainbow Rowell. It's a YA novel. It came out a few years ago. And even now, sometimes I'll read a book and it just makes me go, that's the kind of writer I want to be. And I read that book and man, it just hit me. Like, it was easily the best book I read that year. I read a lot and I read a lot of great books. I don't know if any book has really hit me that in that way since, but it just made me go, this is the kind of writer I want to be. Like, she just immediately with just one book became like my aspirational figure, you know?
Amazing. I want to check this book out.
It's beautifully written and just, gosh, I can't even explain how much I love that book. But it's not so much even recommending that book so much as recommending finding that kind of book that makes you have that feeling of, this is the kind of writer I want to be.
Hey, storytellers, I hope you enjoyed our chat with Cody Keplinger. Don't forget to tweet your favorite quote from Cody's episode and tag at 88 Cups of Tea and include hashtag 88 Cups of Tea so we can find you. The lucky winner will receive a signed advanced copy of Cody's newest book, Run, and get the chance to read it before the book releases in June. She's the founder of Disability in Kid Lit, a site and space dedicated to discussing the portrayal of disability in middle grade and young adult literature to help readers learn about the realities of disability. A huge thank you to Cody for her time and generosity. I loved hearing her story, and I'm so excited to see where her career takes her. To learn more about Cody, be sure to check out her official site at codykeplinger.com. And be sure to say hi to Cody on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you guys so much for tuning in and joining me this week with Cody.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!